This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show, and thank you so much for joining me. This is your host, Jason Hartman, and today we are going to dive in with our guest, Michael Tomsett, talk about real estate valuation and analysis and the Landlord's Toolkit, and I think you'll find this interview to be interesting. One thing I want to say about this interview, and really all interviews and all media in general, and that is the concept that very few people out there really segment the market properly, whether it be a segmentation between linear, cyclical, and hybrid markets, or it be a segmentation between low-price entry-level housing and high-price luxury housing, or middle-market housing, or every different strata in between, or product type, whether it be condos, townhomes, single-family homes, apartments, or other commercial real estate, even for that matter. And you just gotta really understand that and take it with a grain of salt. I'm not necessarily saying that in regard to this guest. I'm making it as a general statement, but as I just dove in and kind of listened to a few segments of this interview that was recorded just about 2 months ago, I believe, you know, it reminded me of that, and I just thought I should say that to you listeners again. Most of you understand and realize that because you've been listening to the show for 732 episodes, but if not, if you're newer to the show especially, make sure you understand that and take everything with a grain of salt always, and always think twice about it rather than just listening to general sound bites. So that is one comment I wanted to make before the interview today, and as a general comment, and also let you know that I am talking to you today from Las Vegas, Nevada, Sin City, otherwise known as Lost Wages, Nevada. It is really just pitiful and disgusting to see the kind of desperation that these casinos cause and gambling. I'm a libertarian. I'm the last guy that's going to say we need another law, right? But I don't know. It's pretty tragic, really, what goes on in the world of gambling, and just a terrible thing. But on the positive side, and I'd love to get your feedback about this, listeners, I have always had the goal of living in a no-income tax state. You know, you're always going to have to pay federal taxes, of course, and they are exorbitant unless you are doing what the government wants you to do, unless you are listening to them and following their incentives. And what are those incentives? Well, they incentivize you to own income property and provide housing to other people. They give you phenomenal tax benefits for doing so, and that's why I always say income property is the most tax-favored asset class in America. So one of the ways that you can really accelerate your wealth creation, and I noticed it myself 5 years ago when I moved from the Socialist Republic of California to Arizona and massively reduced my state income tax bill. But Arizona still has state taxes. Nevada, Florida, Texas, Tennessee, Washington State, Wyoming, and a few others. I think there's 11 states in our wonderful union that do not have state income tax. And, you know, I think it is a very reasonable goal, if you can do it, if you want to do it, to really consider as part of your wealth creation strategy and your tax planning strategy, at some point, hopefully sooner rather than later, to get into a low tax environment, or better yet, a no tax environment. And so I've been looking at houses here in Las Vegas, a city that I've always sort of loved to hate in a way. You know, I don't gamble. I'm not into the Las Vegas strip scene too much or anything like that with all the party lifestyle. Once in a while, sure. I mean, I'm not totally boring, I hope. But, you know, it's not a lifestyle concept. But, you know, when you leave that environment and you just drive 5-10 minutes away from it, it's really quite beautiful out here, if you like the desert, you know, and I live in Scottsdale, Arizona now. This is actually a little prettier than Scottsdale in some ways, and no state income tax. Anyway, I've just been looking at houses out here, and it's been pretty interesting looking at high-end rentals and high-end homes for sale. It's just been a very interesting education the past couple days, and I'm going to do a little more of that today. So I will let you know as it progresses. But if you have any feedback for me on Las Vegas and what you think of it, let me know. For a long time, I thought, well, maybe I should move to Florida. But gosh, you know, if you're a West Coast guy, that's a big move. If you live in Phoenix area, or if you live in Las Vegas, and you're from California, as am I, that's a pretty easy thing. You know, you can still see all your friends, and you still have business contacts in all these areas, of course. And so it's not a big move. It's not a big life-changing move, in other words. And so anyway, would love any of your feedback. I know you listeners always have great feedback. You have great recommendations, and we love hearing from you and love hearing those recommendations from you. We will be announcing real soon a Meet the Masters event. We're negotiating with a couple of different venues now, and we will let you know about that real soon. So that is slated for January-ish of next year. It's our annual event, so stay tuned for more information on that. In the meantime, I know that a few of you have been purchasing, without me even mentioning it lately too much, the HartmanEducation.com products. We've got some bundle specials on suites of products from prior events and so forth. I think you'll really like those. There's a lot to learn there in a more organized rather than a news sort of format like the podcast. Check out HartmanEducation.com. That's HartmanEducation.com. And be sure to check out all of the properties and other resources at JasonHartman.com. And let's dive in and let's hear from our guest. I think you'll enjoy this interview. It's my pleasure to welcome Michael Tomsett to the show. He is the best-selling author of Real Estate Market Valuation and Analysis, The Real Estate Investor's Pocket Calculator, Simple Ways to Compute Cash Flow, Value, Return, and Other Key Financial Measurements, and The Landlord's Financial Toolkit, Getting Started in Real Estate Investing, and J.K. Lasser's Real Estate Investing. Michael, welcome. How are you?
Thank you. I'm doing well. Thanks. How are you doing?
Good, good. Give us a sense of geography. Where are you located?
I'm just south of Nashville, Tennessee.
Good stuff. And you have a background in accounting. You've also written about options trading and some stock market oriented things. And you were trading options before Al Gore invented the internet, I guess, huh?
That's right. I was trading options back in the day when it took sometimes half a day to get a trade placed and confirmed.
Wow.
A lot of paper confirmations, the good old days.
Yeah, that's right about the time Al Gore invented global warming. I like to say ridiculous things.
I think global warming might be caused by his invention of the internet. I'm not sure.
It could be because, you know, he was pontificating about the coming ice age in the late 70s. So, you know.
Yes, he was.
They changed their story. But the nice thing about math is that it's pretty solid, right? and it's something we can really kind of rely on to being consistent. So where do you want to start? Do you want to talk about analyzing a real estate deal maybe and some of these key valuation metrics and such?
Yes, I think that a good starting point might be to talk about a market area analysis. This is something that's very big in a lot of commercial projects. But when you come down to residential real estate, which I assume is of more interest to other folks, to most folks, there are some essential principles of valuation. In fact, there are are actually 9 of them. And if you want, I can go over them very quickly and just explain.
Yeah.
Because collectively they define what a property is worth.
Yeah, absolutely. And just before you do that, I just wanted to maybe even give a broader, much more general thing. When it comes to real estate appraisal, there are 3 basic methods appraisers use. And I know this isn't necessarily valuation, but one, of course, is the comparison approach, most commonly used in residential real estate. Another is the income approach, most commonly used in commercial real estate. And then there's the replacement cost approach, right?
Yes.
So those are the 3 basics, but how do you get to 9?
Well, we're actually talking about 2 different things. I apologize for that. But one thing I wanted to say about these different approaches of appraisal, appraisers in real estate often do those 2 you mentioned, the cost and replacement, and will adjust those to get to what they consider fair market value. However, there seems to be an interest these days in some circles of using the income approach for residential. And the reason for that is, first of all, rental rates are higher than ever, and purchasing records among individuals are lower than ever. I think people are afraid sometimes to buy a home because values have been going down. And so a lot of people that at one time might have bought a house are now actually renting. And for this reason, in the appraisal business, some people are making an argument that the income approach should be used in appraising real estate. In other words, that's based on what the rental value would be of a home multiplied by a multiplier that's used elsewhere in the area. And this may be more accurate, especially when you consider how in the past, especially 2008 and 2009, we saw the consequences of real estate being overappraised and overvalued. So that's just a trend that I'm aware of that might be very interesting for folks in the future.
Sure, okay.
As far as most lenders are concerned, they're still looking at cost and replacement appraisals.
Right, right. Okay, good stuff. So dive into those 9 areas for us, if you would.
Okay. These are called the principles of real estate evaluation, and they're not too complex. They're pretty straightforward. The first 2 are called progression and regression. This simply relates to the fact that market values tend to rise at times. That's progression, and they may tend to fall. Regression. And so those are the first 2 principles that you need to be aware of in order to understand how value is set in real estate.
Okay. So before you go on, just a little bit about that. Is this kind of something you would consider when you're looking at an area that's, say, it seems like over time, most areas tend to kind of go downhill, but some areas become gentrified and they really go up and they get better as people move in, start fixing up their homes and improving neighborhoods.
Yes.
You look at that progression or regression in terms of, you know, you can tell if there's kind of like some pride in a neighborhood or if it's just sort of being abandoned and
it's true.
And it's contagious, isn't it?
Yes. And you just described perfectly those 2 principles. The principle of progression is stated by saying a property's value is likely to increase when there are similar properties in a similar location of greater quality. Regression is the opposite. The value is likely to decrease when there are similar properties in similar locations containing lower quality. So that's exactly what you were just saying. That's progression and regression.
Absolutely. Okay. And I just want to do a little tangent for a second that I think is kind of interesting to what you said. You know, Jim Rohn, many years ago, he said, your income will be the average of the 5 people you spend most of your time with. And this is true of us as people too. If we're hanging around people that aren't going anywhere in life, we're going to have regression.
That's right.
If we're hanging around people that are more successful than us, that are dreaming big, doing big things, learning, constantly growing, we're going to progress. And so our environment is very important and we get to choose it. So we got to control that. Just a little non-real estate side note there I wanted to make.
Well, I guess you could call that a principle of contagion, that success and failure are both contagious, yeah. I guess is a way you could put that.
Absolutely. Good stuff. Okay, what's the next one?
Okay, next one's called conformity. This is a concept that properties are likely to appreciate in value when they're similar to other properties in the same neighborhood. And this becomes important when you consider what happens if you buy a home and over-improve it. So if you're in a neighborhood that is generally 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, and average-sized kitchen, and you improve that to 5 bedrooms and 3 baths and a huge kitchen, you're less likely to get your money back on that because it becomes a non-conforming property.
Okay. Anything else you want to say on that, or does that kind of cover it?
That covers it pretty simply. I think that's about what you need to know about that, that I think a lot of people think that improvements always bring more money, but that's not true.
Right, because it depends what kind of improvements. And of course, we always hear the old standard, well, kitchens and bathrooms are where you want to put the money, but if you put a swimming pool in, that's going to be a loser, right?
Sure. Swimming pool, landscaping, fireplaces, things like that tend to not add value to the home.
Okay, good.
Okay.
All right.
Next is substitution. And this is a principle that states that the greatest potential value of a property is limited by the market value of other properties in a similar condition. This is kind of like conformity, except that it's more about condition than size and features. So you want to see substitution of a property for similar properties that are for sale, because the lower priced properties tend to sell faster. And so as a result, market value of other properties tends to be lowered by that.
Okay, good.
All okay. Right. Then we get to the concept of change. This is number 5, change. This is a principle that states that no condition is going to remain the same indefinitely. Change is part of the cycle. And so property values are changed by the local economy, demographics, employment, age and condition of the property and surrounding properties, the character of the neighborhood. You mentioned gentrification a while ago, and also by natural events like hurricanes and earthquakes. So change is a fact of life. I know that when I lived in California, I happened to move out of the state about 2 months before the earthquake hit in, what year was that? 1989. And I was very fortunate with the timing of that, because as it turned out, property values took a hit right afterwards because of that earthquake. And it was temporary, but that was an example of change.
Okay, good. Move on.
Okay. Yeah. Next is anticipation. This valuation principle states that market value is going to be affected by expectations about the future. For example, let's say that you're moving into an area where you expect a lot of growth and you expect a lot of demand to accompany that growth. You expect employers to come into the area. You expect a lot of services to increase and roads to be improved and rezones and all of that. And so that anticipation will tend to increase the value of property. Of course, the other side of that is that if, in fact, those things don't come to pass, then you have the opposite effect, that values will then go down because anticipation didn't bear fruition.
Okay, so that's a very important concept there, because anticipation takes place in all markets, not just real estate. It's probably most pronounced in the stock market. And the concept that we need to understand as investors is the concept of whether or not that anticipation is what they say priced in. Is it already priced in? So, you know, you could think, okay, they're going to build a new highway that's going to make this area more accessible. Or, you know, maybe on a negative side, it backs, you know, the highway is going to be right behind the house and it's going to be noisy and terrible.
Sure. And those are both forms of anticipation.
Right. Yeah. So positive and negative anticipation. And then the question is that event already priced in? If everybody knows about it, the market might have priced it in already. Same thing
Absolutely.
With stocks, of course.
Absolutely.
So anything more you want to say about that?
No, I think that there's a tendency for people who want to buy a home to be a little bit blind to this point you just made. And so they might think, well, there's going to be a bunch of employers coming here because that's what the real estate agent told me. So I should buy a house now because property values are going to go up, without realizing that, in fact, they may already be priced in, as you said.
Mm-hmm. How do we know if it's priced in, though? I think I'll take a stab at that one before you even answer, but I would do that by saying, you know, how long has the news been out there? How widely known is that news? And how astute is your marketplace? So the one reason I don't like the financial markets, I don't like the stock market very much, is that you've got a very astute marketplace there that is pricing things in very quickly.
Immediately, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, like every time there's a natural disaster or a terrorist attack, they price in the oil markets change, the airline stocks change. It all just goes crazy, doesn't it?
Yeah, often with an overreaction, and that makes things more confusing as well. And I think that another way to judge whether that anticipation factor is in there, first of all, you should assume that the market is efficient and that every known fact has been priced in. But you can also look back on the history of average prices of typical homes in that area. And just like looking at a stock chart, you can tell if the current news is already priced into the stock. But the same holds true with real estate. You can look at the public record of that very house you're thinking of buying, and you can find out what it was worth a year ago, 2 years, 5 years. And so you can tell from that how much of the anticipation has already gone into the price.
Yeah, right, right. Very good. Okay. All right. Tell us more.
Okay, next one is contribution. This is a principle that tells us that improvements will add to market value, but not dollar for dollar, only as a factor of current supply and demand. So what this means is that, and this gets back a lot to the conformity idea that, as you mentioned, a swimming pool is not going to necessarily add to the value of a home, and in some cases it might take away from the value of the home because of the insurance and the maintenance and all of those things.
And in the safety issue. If someone's
and
got
the safety
young
issue,
children.
Sure. Yeah, right. And so there are a couple of concepts that are at work with contribution, and these are the controlling factors about this, which are increasing returns and diminishing returns. So in other words, making improvements to a property is going to cause growth in market value, but only to the extent that improvements exceed the return on the invest or exceed the level of contribution. When it's the opposite, then you're going to get the diminishing returns and have the opposite effect of either having no addition to the value or even a negative, in other words, a decline in value.
You know, that's like it is in life, huh? Someone in a relationship will say, look at all I've done for her, and she doesn't appreciate
yeah.
me. Right? Yeah. Right. Okay. Tell
okay.
us more.
Okay. Number 8 of 9 is called plottage. And this is a principle that says that land values are going to tend to increase when adjacent land or lots are combined into single ownership and put into single zoning or use. So in other words, you want consistency and conformity in zoning, and you want to have what out west a lot they call growth management principles in effect, where you are going to define that a rather broad area is zoned for residential only or for mixed use or for commercial, and the plottage should be consistent in the use of the property in that area. And that's an important point, because the history has shown that when you have a lack of plottage or consistency in plottage, there tends to be a very soft market as a result.
Okay, so you're saying that areas where zoning is very lax and there's an inconsistent land use, that tends to degrade values? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes. And another aspect of plottage is that when you have an actual plan that the planning department or of the city or the county puts the plottage into a well-planned development of a city area, especially residential area, that may subsequently be developed, that that's likely to have a uniform appreciation in value versus people coming in with different size lots and with different size houses and just building where they want, when they want, and then paying to have roads come in. It becomes haphazard, and that takes away from value.
Right. And so that would bode well for the suburbs, and it would bode well for master plan communities, right?
Absolutely. Planned unit developments and everything like that. Absolutely.
Right. But the funny thing is, though, no rule or law applies universally, including this one, right?
Absolutely.
and so sometimes, though, you can make that work to your advantage when you have that nonconformity. If you're the outlier and you get a great deal, and then you can either repurpose the property or market in a different way that it's appealing and seen in a different way by potential buyers or renters, right? You can
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And when you come in and you're going to look at property, you want to see that uniformity of plotage and you want to see that predictability of land use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Good. Good. And okay. Number nine.
Number nine, actually, I have to correct myself. There actually are 10 of these. But number nine is called highest and best use. And this is a very broadly used concept in which it states that valuation of real estate is at its best when land is utilized in the best possible way. And this doesn't just mean residential. It means that rich farmland should be used to farm. And land located next to interstate freeways should be used for commercial zoning or building intermodal facilities or warehouses. So it applies to every type of land use. The highest and best use depends on where it is and what can be put there based on the zoning.
So here's what I want to say about that. Sometimes a tragedy can actually turn out to be a huge opportunity. For example, you look at the devastation of, say, Hurricane Katrina. People that owned crappy old rundown houses in the Gulf area that got wiped out during Hurricane Katrina or any type of scenario like that, as bad as that may have seemed, what happened to many of those people is that some real estate developer came along and wanted to buy that lot where that shack was and build a high-rise condo. And they were willing to pay them a pretty good premium, plus they got the insurance money. Sometimes, as the Chinese say, the symbol for crisis and opportunity is the same.
Yes.
And the crisis can turn out to be a grand opportunity, right?
Yes. In fact, you're describing how highest and best use can change due to unforeseen events. That's a very good point.
Okay, good. Good stuff. So we went through all 10?
Actually, that was number 9.
Oh, that's the, 9. Okay, the last, there's the bonus round.
The last
round.
One is pretty important, however. It's called competition.
Good. Okay.
And that is related to the broader concept of supply and demand. It basically states that an opportunity for a profitable investment leads to competition. And if you think about that, let's say that you're looking at a plot of land, a raw land, and you're thinking, wow, I should buy that before everyone else sees how great it is in this area. If you're right, and a lot of people start buying land around you, then the county is going to be compelled to build roads and put in utilities and, the basic services. If you're wrong, and no one else comes in, then you're going to lose the value of your investment because there is no competition. So the smart investor is going to be somebody who is going to recognize that competition grows from recognizing opportunities. And opportunities sometimes mean identifying the best possible investment. And that often translates, by the way, to buying a rundown house on an otherwise good block.
Okay, so that actually is a great point you just made. There's a common thought process, which I think is mostly true, but it's certainly not always true. And I just wanted to get your comment on this, of the idea of always buy the worst house in the best neighborhood concept, right?
Yes.
You've heard that one.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that if you're going to do any sort of fixer-upper, for example, if you could find a rundown house on an otherwise well-kept block, that's a good investment on several levels. First of all, when you fix it up, and often cosmetically, you're going to get a good return on your money. And sometimes that means painting the outside, clearing out the brush, and redoing the landscaping. These are cosmetic things that most people can do on their own. Not only are you going to see an appreciation of your property, but your neighbors are going to see appreciation in their property as well. So this is a win-win. That's a good type of investment that pleases everybody and brings profit to everybody. It also tends to raise the rents you're going to get if you decide to make it a rental property. Makes you a great neighbor if you decide to move in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good stuff. Okay, we talked about these different things, and that was very very educational, I think, for a lot of our listeners that don't necessarily think about this stuff. I remember way back in the old days studying about how there are improvements to a property that can be made or already in existence when you're considering buying the property that don't necessarily add any value. And I remember one of the examples was used as a well for water. And a well is something that we don't really notice, and it doesn't really matter necessarily how deep the well is or how much it costs to put the well in. It just matters that the result is water comes out of the faucets, right? And so a seller of a property might spend a fortune and say, look at this deep well I had to put in to bring you water, right? Now, of course, we're talking about non-city type properties here. We all get that. But, you know, the example applies to probably a lot of things. And the buyer's like, I don't care. The house down the street has water and yours has water. So what? The seller is not going to get more money for the deeper well, right?
It's an invisible improvement. It's sort of like, this is why real estate agents don't like the sellers to be there when they show a home, because it's kind of destructive to their own interests when a seller hears somebody complain and say, well, this room's kind of dark. And then the current owner says something like, you should have seen it before I painted it. I mean, that might be true that it was improved, but the would-be buyer doesn't see that improvement. And it certainly doesn't help make the case that the house is a good investment or a good residence for that new person because they didn't see it beforehand.
I think you're absolutely right. And so if you have gold-plated plumbing that's under the sink, the buyer doesn't care, okay? You know, so don't overimprove.
And they don't plan to, and they don't think they should have to pay for that either, especially if it's invisible.
Yeah, absolutely. Good points. Okay, I know we've got to wrap it up here fairly soon, but I just wanted to ask you a little bit about the Landlord's Financial Toolkit. Can you tell us about that a little?
Well, the first thing I'd like to tell you is that just this week, I have signed a contract with Amacom Books to do a second edition of this book. This first came out in 2005.
Oh, fantastic.
And we're going to change the title to The Real Estate Investor's Financial Toolkit. I guess the sense of on the part of the publisher is that landlord might have a negative connotation for some folks, especially tenants. And so,
listen, I love being a landlord. So
I did too. I did that for many years. But
the whole idea that the word lord is in the title is pretty cool.
Well, I did it for many years, so, and I understand both sides of it, I think.
Right. Yeah, good stuff. But what are some of the tools that should be in every landlord or investor's toolkit?
Well, on this particular book, of course, in addition to sort of setting up and talking about the justification for real estate as a sound investment, I think some of the tools that you need to have are a very good bookkeeping system and a very good way of tracking transactions. Because when you get into real estate, I think you don't realize at first that there's a lot of transactions and a lot of it's done in cash, because you go down Sunday to Home Depot and buy a part that you need for your rental, and you forget to take your credit card or your checkbook, so you pay cash, and you need to have a system for tracking those things. Otherwise, you lose a lot of deductions, and you need to know how to calculate taxes and depreciation and appreciate the tax rules. Real estate is probably the only investment available that not only generates cash income, but allows you to write off up to a limit a net loss on your investments. So you need to know about tax reporting. You need to know about how real estate is going to work in terms, not so much of profit on the real estate, but in terms of cash flow. And this is a tool you need, is to be able to master the difference between those two things and to figure out how to actually calculate cash flow. And I spend a lot of time in the book, and will in the new edition as well, in explaining how to calculate cash flow and why it's so important.
Right, sure.
Absolutely. So that's a few of the tools.
Yeah, and you know, income property is the most tax-favored asset class in America.
Absolutely.
And taxes are the single largest expense in anybody's life. So we've got to understand taxation and invest in things that are so incredibly beneficial as far as taxation goes in terms of saving money. Because when you add up the time value of money on tax savings, over, you know, 5-10 years, it's just enormous. And if you're in an occupation where you're paying the highest tax brackets and you have no deductions like good real estate, you're just missing out. I mean, it just totally separates the haves from the have-nots.
It's the last remaining tax shelter, and it's an amazing tax shelter in the sense that not only can you deduct expenses and shelter income through depreciation, for example, but you also get to generate current income by renting out homes.
Yeah, I know. I love it. It's a multidimensional asset class, and you outsource the obligation of your debt to your tenant. You pay it back in cheaper dollars over time through inflation and
yes.
the time value of money. And it just works, you know, you leverage tax benefits. It's just
pretty amazing.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
It's such a great asset class. It really is. Michael, I got to ask you, how many books have you written? Wow. You are a prolific author. In addition to the ones I mentioned, you've got a whole bunch more, right?
Well, a book just came out that was my 90th book, and it's Career Press,
wow.
called Making Money with Option Strategies, subtitled Powerful Hedging Ideas for the Serious Investor to Reduce Portfolio Risk. That's number 90.
90? Wow.
Well,
I got
nothing else going on right now,
you
man.
Are...
I mean, I've been doing this for 35 years, and that's about an average of 2.5 to 3 books a year.
Yeah.
You know, it takes me about 3 months to write a book, so that's not that extraordinary.
That is totally amazing, I just want to say.
Somebody told me the other day that few people have read 90 books, even
yeah,
though they write 90 books.
That's a sad commentary on today's world. It really is.
But it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, give out your website, and of course, you can search Michael Tomsett on Amazon and find 90 books. But where else should they find you?
Okay. Well, my website is called Tomsett Publishing Website, and it's on http://, Tomsett Publishing, one word, .weebly.com. That's weebly.com.
Fantastic. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
And I'm also all over the social media, by the way, too. So if anyone wants to read free articles, I post them daily on stockcharts.com and thestreet.com and Seeking Alpha.
Fantastic. Good stuff. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jason. This is great fun.